take a comfortable but alert posture and softly close your eyes. And during this period of meditation, I'm going to do a guided meditation for you, and you're welcome to follow along. Or if you don't care to do a guided meditation, you're welcome to tune me out as you wish. So you might start by taking a couple of deep breaths, and as you breathe out, to relax. Let go. The out-breath is often a time when we release, when we let go. And the more consciously aware we are of our breathing, the easier the natural process of letting go can happen as we breathe out. So then letting yourself breathe normally, whatever that is, letting your breath breathe itself. Take a few moments to feel your body, how your body is right now. Feeling the contact of your body against the floor, against your chair. Feeling how the torso arises upright into the space, to the room. Feeling how the neck and the head sits on top of the torso. And what the guided meditation will consist of is I will direct your attention systematically to different parts of your body, starting at the top of your head, and we'll move down through to the feet. And as you feel, as your attention is placed in each of these places, begin by just feeling that place, feeling what it feels like, that part of your body. Exploring it, getting to know it, sensing it, the felt sense of that place in your body. And do that for a few breaths, just feeling it. And then for a couple of breaths, on the out-breath, relax and let go of that place to whatever degree you can. Some of the places your attention is directed, you'll have strong sensations. Some places you'll feel maybe no sensations at all. Some places you'll be able to relax and some places not. The important thing is mostly just to bring your attention to that part of your body. And just allow what's there to be there. And then the last couple of breaths to just relax to whatever degree you can on the out-breath. So we begin by bringing our attention to the top of the head, crown of the head. Feeling whatever sensations are there, however subtle they might be. Perhaps sensations of pressure, vibration, tingling. Letting the awareness explore the top of the head. And then as you breathe out, release that part of your body, relax it. You don't have to try too hard to do this. You don't have to even succeed at relaxing. Just as softly, gently, as you breathe out, see if there can just intend a little bit of softening. And then move your attention down to your forehead and feel your forehead. Feeling what the skin is on your forehead, how it feels. Maybe how it sits on the bone of your skull. The tension or the pressure or the warmth that might be there. And then as you breathe out, release that part of your body. Let it soften. And then move your attention to your eyes, feeling the eyelids on the eyes and the eye socket. There's no need to judge whatever sensations you're having. Simply allow them to be as they are, sensing and feeling them. And then as you breathe out, release your eyes, let them relax, soften. And then you can feel your nose. Tingling, pressure, warmth, coolness, tension. And then as you breathe out, soften the nose. And then feel your cheeks and your jaws. Some of us carry a lot of tension in our jaws. It's fine to let it be there. Just experience what's happening. At first, without any attempt to relax anything, just simply to feel. And then as you breathe out, release, relax your jaws, your cheeks. Not worrying about how well you're doing. And then bring your attention to your lips. the front of your mouth, sensing and feeling what it is to have a mouth, lips. And then as you breathe out, soften the lips, the mouth. And then move your attention to your chin. How is it your chin experiences itself? What are the sensations that are evident there? And then as you breathe out, let go of your chin, of the tension there. Let go and soften the chin. And then move your attention to your neck, feeling the muscles of the neck, feeling the muscles that support the head, feeling the sensations of your neck. Getting to know it. And then without any force or expectation or demand, as you breathe out, let there be a softening in the neck. As the out-breath gets released, let there be a release in the neck. And then you can feel the front of the neck, the throat area, feeling the throat, sensing it, allowing it to be whatever way it is. And then as you breathe out, soften the throat. And then you can feel your shoulders. The weight, the heaviness of the shoulders, the tension that might be there, the warmth, the hardness, perhaps the movement of the shoulders as you breathe. And then with the release of the out-breath, let there be a release or softening in the shoulders. And then feel your chest, the front of your chest. And then as you breathe out, let go of the chest, release the chest. And then let your attention go to your back. First, with a sense of discovery, just to experience what it is to have a back, how your back is right now. Without any judgment, just letting it be as it is. The back rib cage. The shoulder blades. The lower back. And then as you breathe out, let go of your back. Let it soften and relax. Let it be released. And then you can feel your stomach, your abdomen, a place where many people hold. Feel whatever's happening in your abdomen. Maybe some tension, maybe some movement as you breathe. Maybe some hardness, maybe softness. Feeling the abdomen from the inside. And then on the out-breath, with the release of the out-breath, let there be a softening of the stomach. A release of the stomach. And then you can feel your arms and your hands. Letting the sensations in your arms and the hands reveal themselves to you as you let the awareness move around the arms, sensing what's there. And as you breathe out, relax, let go of your arms and your hands. And then let your attention move down to your area of your hips, your groin, your butt. Feel that whole area. Let the sensations of that area have their chance to be experienced in awareness. And then as you breathe out, let there be a softening. A relaxing. And then feel your legs. Sense and feel how it's what's happening with your legs right now. Allowing the sensations to be there. And then as you breathe out, release your legs. And then moving your attention to your feet. Spending a few moments feeling the feet, the soles of the feet, the toes. And then as you breathe out, let there be some softening in the feet. And then feel now your whole body, whatever sense you have of your whole body, the sense of bodily presence. And then as you breathe out, let go. Yield your body to softening. Any places of holding, of resistance, of holding back in the body, let it soften as you breathe out. And then bring your attention to wherever in your body you feel the breath, the breathing, most strongly. Maybe you feel the breathing in your chest or your stomach or your nose. And notice how your breathing is right now. And then continue for a few minutes paying attention to your breath. And without any force, with a gentleness, really allow the exhalation to be conscious. So you're consciously aware of the release and letting go as you breathe out. Not forcing the letting out. resting there, surfing on the release with the exhalation. As you breathe out, release and let go of any thoughts and concerns you have in your brain. Softly release your brain. So that was quite a different kind of meditation than what we usually do in mindfulness. I think those of you who have been coming for a while know that the usual way we teach mindfulness is a pure awareness practice, where we specifically are not trying to relax or specifically not trying to change anything, but rather just simply bring awareness to what's actually happening right now. And the mindfulness practice is in part a training to strengthen our capacity and ability to bring just simply awareness to what's happening right now in the very moment. And what often happens is if we try to change what's happening, which is often our tendency, if we don't like something or if we want something different, is we try to manipulate and change the situation. is that what happens often enough is that we often miss ourselves in looking for something in the future that's better, in resisting the present moment. And what we're trying to do with mindfulness practice is to train ourselves to experience the present moment with some real depth. There's nothing, you know, it can be fine to try to change yourself if you need to change things. But many of us spend a whole lifetime always looking into the future, whether it's the next second or the next minute or the next year or the next decade or whatever. If only, or when only things get better, when only things are like that, then I'll finally be okay. I'll be a success, I'll be whatever. And mindfulness practice works on the function, on the principle that you don't have to sacrifice the present moment in the hope or in the expectation that in the future you'll have a better situation. But rather you can enter into the present experience and experience it fully, and with, we can maybe say, with some depth. So we experience our life deeply rather than shallowly by always being concerned about the future or concerned about the past or always trying to get away from the kind of present moment experience we have. What happens is that if we're always kind of chasing after something different than what's happening or resisting what's happening, we end up living kind of on the surface of our lives, and we often end up strangers to ourselves, because who we are deeply is a human being in the present moment. And all our ideas about who we are or going to be in the future or who we've been in the past are only ideas. And ideas are always somewhat shallow compared to the full depths of how we can experience ourselves in the present moment. There's maybe one way, of exemplifying this. There's a story of some students, I guess Taoist students, who were arguing, discussing the famous line by Lao Tzu, I think, that says, those who know do not say, and those who say do not know. You probably heard this before. And so what does this mean? You know, and who would be presumptuous enough to try to explain it? So they, you know, were in a quandary. So they went to the master and asked the master, you know, well, can you explain the statement? And he said, how many of you know what a rose, know what a rose is? And they all said, yeah, well, we all know what a rose is. Okay, how many of you can, how many of you know the smell of a rose? When you smell a rose, you know the perfume and the aroma of a rose. How many of you know it? Oh yeah, we know it. How many of you can describe what the smell of a rose is like? And then they were silent. I think that the idea being that most of us have smelled a rose and knows what it's like, and usually it's kind of pleasant and nice to smell. But if you're going to try to put in words to describe the experience of smelling a rose, I think for most of us, unless we're great poets, that any description we come up with is going to be much fall quite a bit short, be quite a bit flatter than the actual experience of smelling the rose. It's the same thing with our lives. If we experience our lives through our ideas and concepts, ideas of who we are, who our world is, who our friends are, who our spouses are, whatever, if it's always through the window of our ideas and our concepts, we're actually experiencing it very flatly, very shallowly, what's actually happening. And in order to experience our life with some depth, the place to experience with some depth includes something much greater than just our concepts and our ideas. Just like to just say that the rose is sweet misses a lot, doesn't it? There's a lot more going on in the smell of a rose than it's just a sweet smell or something. To experience ourselves, you know, to have some concept about ourselves as I'm a failure, or I'm a doctor, or I'm a, you know, whatever I am, or I'm neurotic, or I must be the most spiritually sophisticated person here, or whatever kind of concept or ideas we have, it actually will be very shallow. If we see ourselves only through that lens, we experience ourselves very shallowly. And part of the function of mindfulness practice is to help us to enter into the present moment, not to change it, but enter it so we can experience ourselves much more fully, experience the full width and depth of what the present moment is like. And I think this is a very profound principle, because if we feel the profundity of the present moment, the profundity of ourselves in the present, I think we'll have a different relationship to our problems. Most of us have problems in our life. And you can name your problems. You probably have a litany of things that are causing suffering for you. And it isn't that you should maybe stop, you know, trying to figure them out or solve them in a sense. But your relationship to your problems will be different if you stop seeing them only through the lens of concepts and ideas about them, judgments, values, interpretations of what they mean, which are all ideas, and actually experience a depth and fullness of what it's like. And if you experience the depth and fullness of your suffering, of your problems, it'll probably be much more livable and much more manageable. You'll feel a kind of richness to life in the fullness of the experience that you'll miss if you only stay with your interpretations, your meanings, your categories you put the experience in. Does that make sense? There's I came across a wonderful account recently of an anthropologist who went to Siberia to study some native peoples there. And he came across a 14-year-old boy who was acting rather unusually. He would do things like eat bark off the trees. He was a normal kid, kind of doing a normal kind of 14-year-old kind of thing. And then suddenly one day he started doing his unusual things. He would start eating bark off the trees. He would take off all his clothes and go running into the Siberian forest in the middle of the winter, which is usually not a very good idea. And he would talk in tongues and kind of babble and do all kinds of strange things. And he would cut himself with a knife, his skin. Now, in America, if a 14-year-old boy did that kind of behavior, if any of us did that kind of behavior, it would be chances are fairly good that it would tend to be placed in a category of, to put it most broadly, as this is something unhealthy or wrong or inappropriate. This is a problem. And the place to go probably is a psychiatrist. Probably a psychiatrist in an institution where you get placed. Where you'll be safe in the institution. They'll take care of you. They'll shackle you up. And they'll give you some drugs and sedate you and kind of numb you out and try to explain to you better concepts to live your life by. I think that's generally a fair statement, what happened in this culture, approximately. Well, what was very interesting to this anthropologist was that in Siberia, this young boy was treated very specially. He was seen as having some kind of special gift or some special quality. And he was kind of taken aside and then trained by the elders of the community to be a shaman. And that what he was doing was actually opening to some deeper door of some deeper connection to reality, to self, to the community, whatever. And it was honored and it was kind of considered sacred. And it was kind of, it wasn't seen as a problem, it was seen as something really great. I'm not in the business to make judgments about which, you know, it was really great this boy was behaving this way or whether it was pathological. I don't want to be in that business. But the point I wanted to make is that something that is so central to our culture as deciding what a person's psychological life is like and what the appropriate psychological life is somewhat arbitrary and is often seen through certain lenses. And there's other lenses, other interpretations that are possible that put it in a whole different context that doesn't see it as a problem but sees it as something good. And many of us, when we have things happen to us in our lives, many of us will put it in a category. And we suffer because of the category we put it in. For example, if we have certain emotions, and we put the emotions in a category, oh, I shouldn't be having these emotions. There's something wrong about me. For example, if I get depressed, depression means that I'm doing life wrong. I'm a failure. I better not let people know I'm depressed because it's kind of embarrassing. I should know better than get depressed. It's kind of unfortunate to be depressed. And maybe I need, it's a bad sign. Something is wrong with me that I'm depressed. I need to go to a therapist to get fixed because something's wrong with me because I'm depressed. And I'm embarrassed. I better not show any of my friends. And what a, you know, I can't do anything right. Now I'm a depressed person on top of it. And there's all these meaning and interpretation that a person can place on top of depression. And what I suggest is that many of us, a lot of the suffering we add to our life is unnecessary, arises sometimes because of the category we place a certain situation in. And it's possible to have other contexts to hold a certain experience. I've known people who've seen depression not as a problem, but maybe a little bit like in Siberia, seen depressions as a gift. Because being depressed indicates that something powerful is moving inside of us. Maybe some powerful resistance or something. But it means something, as Rilke said in one of his letters to a young poet, something powerful that wants to come out of you. And so it's a good sign. Or the guest house by Rumi, who says, who knows, you know, why you feel sad or depressed or why there's some grief going on. Maybe it's some wonderful seed deep inside of you that's bubbling out to give blossom to a new flower. We don't know what, you know. So we often put things in contexts that add unnecessary suffering on top of ourselves. We don't know what's happening within us. So the training of mindfulness is a very powerful training, I believe, which is trying its best not to put our experience in a context of a concept or our idea, but to enter the present moment fully, to let ourselves experience ourselves in a deeper way than just through concepts. And what happens miraculously, still miraculously, is that when we see ourselves through concepts, let me say it this way, Buddhism is an antidote to grasping. That's kind of one of the fundamental purposes of Buddhist practice, is to help release us from all grasping, all our clingings, our neurotic holdings onto things, or neurotic resistances, pushing away things. Because these are sources of suffering. I lost my train of thought. So that's the way it goes. So what was I saying?
Interpretation.
Interpretation. Completely gone. Buddhism is an antidote to any kind of holding on. And it's gone. Let it go. It's a strange thing to be giving public talks, you know, and these monologues, and sometimes I kind of get kind of ahead of myself or behind myself. And oh yes, now I remember. So Buddhism is an antidote to grasping, but the only thing we ever grasp at is concepts, is ideas, judgments, categories, contexts we place things in. And this takes some analysis to really understand this is the case, or some deep mindfulness to see this is the case. So to enter the present moment deeply, to experience the present moment beyond our concepts, that is more than just our ideas, is to begin experiencing ourselves outside of suffering, outside of this grasping. And as we do that, as we experience ourselves in a wider field than just grasping, the grasping we have in our life, or the resistance, or the holding, or whatever it is, will naturally have room, in a sense, to begin to soften and relax. So when we allow ourselves to enter the present moment, not to change it, not to do anything about it, but to enter it, to experience it fully, beyond the concepts, in a sense, it allows the holding to be there as it wants to be, allows our suffering to be there as it is. But as we do that, miraculously, the holding begins to kind of feel like it can have breathing room, and it releases itself and softens. And to use the word breathing room, I think, is very apt, because there's a phenomenal connection between what our mind does in terms of tension and holding and resistance and what happens to our breathing. And if you study your breathing, if you study your whole body, what happens to your body, you see the tremendous connection between the way which we grasp at concepts in our mind and how that gets translated directly into then a constriction or a tightness or tension in the body. And as we release the tension in the body, I think you'll notice that the tensions in the mind, the graspings of the mind, the concepts begin to soften also. And naturally you'll begin experiencing life more deeply or more fully than you would be if you're only seeing it through the lenses of your ideas. So we did this little exercise, in this sitting, of actually doing something which is not Vipassana practice, because we were actually changing things. We were relaxing. Usually in mindfulness practice, we don't try to relax. So on the out-breath, the instruction was to kind of soften or let go or relax. And you kind of go through the body systematically as you did that. So I'm very curious how that was for some of you. Yes?
You surprised me because you've never done it before, and I've been coming for a long time. I had my eyes closed already anyway, so all of a sudden you start doing that, and I'm like, okay. But it works. It definitely works well.
I apologize to those of you who expect the fixed routine here.
This is my first time here, and I thought it was...
Yes?
There were a number of places in my body that I couldn't actually feel. And so I found that I was dealing with ideas about these places in my body rather than the actual places themselves.
Can you give an example of an idea?
Well, just trying to imagine what my chest might feel like, since I'm not actually picking up any sensations. And maybe trying to reconstruct memories of times when I could feel it, when I did have strong sensations there.
So that's to revert to the world of concepts and ideas.
Right, yeah.
And usually what the instructions is if you find a place in your body which is numb or blank, the deepest thing you can do at that moment is to hang out with the blankness. Feel the numbness or feel the nothingness that's there. Just hang out there with nothingness for a while. Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit hard because the mind often wants to kind of ricochet off nothing, but just hang out there and know that in a few moments we'll go on to someplace else. And many people have parts of their body which they don't feel very much of. Sometimes it has to do with shutting parts of ourselves off. There's a phenomenal connection between the body and our psyche and our emotions. And when we shut off parts of our psyche, parts of our emotional life, there's almost always a direct corollary in the body. We shut out feelings in certain parts of the body. So we're not in mindfulness practice, we're not in a hurry to heal that. But certainly when there's a place where there's numbness, is to bring attention to it and just wash it with awareness. And maybe for a long time you feel nothing. And then slowly some kind of aliveness begins to surface again.
Interesting. Then I had the impulse that I should feel something there. Something's wrong because I should have a feeling there. Because it's being directed to experience the feelings there. I finally decided just to sort of sit there with not being able to feel it.
Great. So you did the right thing, yeah. But one of the right things is to notice your tendencies. So to notice our judgments. Oh, I have that kind of human mind. I judge my experience. I'm not doing it right. Isn't that interesting? That's the spirit of mindfulness. That's the way it works for me. As opposed to, I'm doing it wrong. And he told me not to judge. Boy, am I ever doing it wrong. Yes?
My ears felt left out.
Oh.
I kept trying. As we got down further, I realized we weren't going to get to it. I tried to relax them, and they wouldn't. They were complaining.
They felt left out. I'm sorry. I apologize to your ears. When you get home, you can do some, emergency relaxation. No, you're welcome to try this at home, and you can, then you include it more fully. Yes?
I had a hard time with it. I was I would get, partway through, I got really relaxed, and I really wanted to go to sleep. And I was like, I've got to listen to more of this, and I really wanted to go to sleep. And so it was a struggle to stay awake.
I see. Generally, when you meditate, you don't want to bother with struggles. So, which means you just fall asleep. and actually, in terms of relaxation, it's done all it needs to do. If you're that relaxed, you begin to fall asleep. It's done what it has to do. You know, go to sleep. Just don't fall off the chair. And that often happens when if you get really relaxed. The tendency is to get kind of tired or fall asleep, especially if we're really tired or have sleep deprivation. But it's also very important to recognize this, because when we do mindfulness meditation, sometimes we do sometimes get quite calm. And in order to continue with the strong mindfulness rather than falling asleep, you have to recognize that as you get calmer and calmer, you might get sleepy, or the mind gets so relaxed that the mind, rather than paying attention, jumps on to the next thought train that comes along and wanders off. And so as you get calmer, you have to also bring with it, add to that, a little bit more vigilance. Kind of bring some more energy of vigilance. Try to pay a little bit more careful attention so the mind doesn't wander off or fall asleep. But for this purpose of today, you should just fall asleep. And I would expect that some of you have a hard time doing this. That's a given, and it's okay.
Well, I actually found it an interesting mindfulness practice. That is, the way I experienced it was that I was substituting these other body parts for following my breath. And so it was very interesting to watch that, because when you're following your breath all the time, there's a danger of it becoming a habit, and you're not really conscious of it. And so by changing it, I was able to find different things. And what I discovered was, when I couldn't feel something, I experienced fear. And I my God, I'm really, there's so, oh my God, what's happening? Why can't I feel this? And then I realized that there was really no terrible consequence to not being able to feel it. And that I really didn't have to be afraid. And then I could feel it. It was a very interesting series of things, so I found it real interesting mindfulness exercise.
So it was actually a combination of a mindfulness and relaxation exercise. The way this is done as a pure mindfulness meditation in some schools of Buddhism is you don't do the relaxation part, the letting go part on the exhalation. All you do is you systematically bring your attention to different parts of the body, going from the head down to the toes, and just feel what's there. And then you go into the next place and feel what's there, what's not there, and kind of do it. And people, you can actually do it, and kind of do it systematically. Do it maybe in a session you can do it one whole sweep of the body in 45 minutes. Or you can get into it and actually do a sweep in 5 minutes. So in 45 minutes, you do 9 sweeps. Just go through. And some people who are really into doing this as their primary practice can actually sweep through the body in just a matter of a minute or something. Just yes.
Well, I noticed this time and other times when you've done this that I have a real hard time dropping down just to the sensation level and not forming a mental image of whatever it is that I'm supposed to be concentrating on. And I'm wondering, since something like a hand is a concept really, is it possible to note the sensation of the hand without sort of forming the concept that goes with it so that you can identify?
Can you?
Yeah. Okay, never mind.
Some of us think through images more than through words. And rather than thinking don't think of it as a problem that you kind of form an image of these different parts of your body. Just leave that in the background. Don't try to erase it, to stop it. Just know that it's happening And then knowing it's happening, try to kind of get below it in a sense, or in front of it or something, and to actually feel the sensations. Just like when someone squeezes your hand, you'd feel the squeezing. Or if you hold your hand like this, I feel, you know, vibration and a little bit of tightness in my hand right now. But I could also have the image at the same time. Does that make sense? So rather than setting these two things in conflict with each other, the image and the sensation, if your tendency is to form an image, allow that to happen, but let it be in the background. Okay. Yes?
I felt just extremely distracted. Like I missed whole body parts. But when I was actually concentrating on what you were saying, it was very relaxing. But I just kept sort of relaxing so much. It's just that I just sort of wore off somewhere.
Yeah, there's many reasons a person would get distracted doing a meditation like this. One is the one you described, that a person is very relaxed. And with the relaxation, there's no more discipline of the mind, and the mind just wanders off thinking about something. Also, for some people, it's actually, you know, like when Maria said, she felt fear. It could actually be very threatening for some people to actually feel parts of their body that store up a lot of these repressed memories or repressed emotions and feelings. And so, one of the functions sometimes of distractions is to distract us from feeling what we don't want to feel. So some people who go systematically through the body will come to these places where they get kind of uh-oh, and they check out into some kind of thought where it's safer. So I'm not saying that happened to you, but there's a number of reasons that a person might be distracted. Another reason is that they came distracted to today. They're just, you know, the mind's already really busy and preoccupied about something, and they couldn't let go of it, so they're sitting here just continuing. Catherine, you had your hand?
No, I'm sure.
So, what else? Anything else you want to talk about today? We have a few minutes. Yes?
I'm curious if you listen to other teachers throughout your week or throughout the month, do you go and visit and listen to other meditation teachers speak like you do to us?
Not so much. Not my daily life. But I teach retreats with other teachers.
With
a teacher. So like just 2 weeks ago, I was teaching a 10-day retreat with Mary Orr and John Travis. And then we sit in, and when we give Dharma talks, we were there listening to each other's talks. And so I teach with, you know, in the course of a year, I might teach with, you know, 8 different teachers. So, like in that way. And maybe one of the questions you're asking indirectly is, do I spend time with a teacher? Do I have a teacher at this point in my life? And I don't really have an active, ongoing relationship now with a teacher, where I'm working with a teacher. There are people who I consider my teachers these days, but I don't have an ongoing relationship to them, like I go sit with them and hang out with them.
But it would seem to me that you would need input from the outside to keep growing. It's something that, you know, I enjoy very much in going and seeing, hearing different people talk. Then I begin to get more depth or contrasting ideas on the same subject.
Right. Yeah, that's an interesting issue for me personally. I've spent many, many decades, you know, 2 decades or more, going and studying with teachers. So I have I've listened to a lot of teachers. You know, so. I mean, how much do you want to listen to teachers? It makes a lot of sense to me that people, you know, come for a while here and, you know, listen to me or listen to teachers or speak here, and then they come for maybe different people. People come for a few months, people come for a few years, some people come for a few decades, different reasons. But it makes some sense to me at some point people also kind of move on and do something else. I mean, how many different ways can I say the same thing? I've listened to a lot. But there's a lot of different, personally, so you're asking kind of a personal question, right? Is that the point? So you're asking a personal question of me, so I should answer personally?
Yeah, I was just curious what of you, and also what if a teacher needs that type of input from other teachers.
Oh, I think...
You
I think
always need it.
Well, I am of the philosophy, or the faith, that you always need teachers. You could always use teachers. There's never any shortage of things to learn and places to develop. So I have no problem with hanging out with teachers and learning from other teachers. And I mean, I have these people that one of the things that's happening at Spirit Rock, there's a teacher collective. And partly we function as each other's teachers, not just simply in listening to each other's talks, but actually we have kind of group meetings and where we give each other feedback and where we talk about Dharma topics and have discussions and get into issues, interpersonal issues that have by way of practicing. And it's actually a very powerful collective to be part of, to be working together that way. And I think all the teachers at Spirit Rock have other teachers outside of the Spirit Rock teacher collective who they go and check with and things like that. I was very impressed by this tea teacher, the example of this tea teacher named Nakamura Sensei, who died just this year. She was a tea teacher at San Francisco Zen Center for many, many years. And she finally went back to Japan a few years ago, and she was like in her 80s or something, late 80s. And some years ago, maybe, I don't know when, maybe 20 years ago, 15 years ago, she had a tea teacher in Japan who was older than her. And that was her teacher. And that teacher died. And her response when that teacher died, she went back to Japan to find another teacher. And she found another teacher, someone who was about 50 years her junior, who hadn't had, you know, 70-some years or 60-some years of studying and teaching tea as she had. And maybe knew a lot less about tea. But she might have been, you know, knew a lot more than him. But she felt it was very important that you always have a teacher. Someone who you go to and present yourself to. And say, this is what's going on with me, and kind of provides feedback and all that. And I thought that was a marvelous example of, you know, someone who, you know, was kind of about as senior as you get in the world of tea. So I feel the same way with us, you know, that we never, there's never a reason not to have a teacher. So myself, I don't actually, having said that, I don't actually work really closely with any teachers anymore now. I haven't for about 2 or 3 years. But I have them. They're there watching me. And they will let me know if they think I need to. Yes?
A lot of times for me, thinking is what's happening right now. Thinking about things at work when I'm at work, or thinking about other things. And that's the present for me. It's not how my nose feels or how my ears feel. It's what's going on in my mind. And they're not, you know, idle thoughts drifting through. They're concentrated on something. And when you went through various things, did it go through the brain?
At the end I did. The very end I did. What to say? It's a whole subject in itself. And if you've never been to the introductory course that I do, I'll start next one in about a month. I think the 24th of September. Does that sound right? You might especially come to the fourth week where I talk about thoughts and how thoughts are included as part of the practice. In some meditation traditions, thought is a problem. You're trying to get rid of them or stop them. And in our tradition, thoughts are our friends, and they become part of the practice. We don't exclude them. However, many of us are addicted to our thoughts. And so one of the things we want to learn through doing mindfulness practice is to become free of our thoughts so they're not running us. So we're not addictively thinking or completely preoccupied without any choice in the matter. To have some choice in the matter, to have some freedom about when we think and not think. So that's one thing. And when thinking is the main thing happening in the present moment, we want to bring, in pure mindfulness practice, we bring our mindfulness to that event of thinking. We recognize that's what's going on, that's what's happening in the present moment. then as we recognize it and as we accept it to be there, we want to start experiencing that in a deeper way, more fully, in a sense. And one way to experience it more fully, if there's a lot of strong thinking going on, there's more to that than just the content of the thought. There's the energetic involvement with it. There's what's happening in the body, perhaps some tightening or tensioning in the body, a vibration or something in the body's different places. And so you can start opening up to the bigger picture of what's actually happening when the event of thinking in the present is happening. And as soon as we open up to something that's bigger, that's more than just the thoughts themselves, then whatever tendency we have to grasp or to be addicted to those thoughts has room to relax. But as long as we're completely preoccupied narrowly and constrictively with our thinking, there's often very little room for those thoughts and preoccupations to relax into. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
Could you say something about striving and non-striving thoughts? I'm wrestling with more the striving element of my thinking.
So can you give me an example of what you strive for? Or would you...
The striving thoughts tend to be something that works against being in the moment. That I'm that I'm not doing now. That I'm worried or focused or thinking or planning or plotting some future event rather than now. So I have a great deal of difficulty keeping the two, what I experience as the two modes of thought.
Ah, okay, good, good. What you might consider is, in mindfulness practice, you always want to be sensitive to any sense of struggle between two things like that. Because a struggle shouldn't be necessary. So that's kind of like, you know, so if you have struggle, it means that maybe there's a different way of looking at it, or kind of different angle, rather than you have to choose one or the other. And one, perhaps this will work for you, and that is, when you're striving for something in the future, that striving is happening in the present moment. So the first thing to do is to recognize that in the present moment, what's happening in the present moment is striving. If you've done that, you've done the meditation successfully. What happens is we very quickly forget that it's, you know, that it's in the present moment. But as long as you're aware that this is what you're doing in the present moment, you've created some room for it. And you're doing the practice. As you've created some room for it and kind of can stay in the present moment with that event of striving, just letting it be there, not being troubled by it, not trying to make it different, not judging it as being, I'm doing it wrong because Gil says, you know, just be in the present or whatever. Just kind of be with the striving. As an event in the present moment, then you want to kind of begin sensing more fully what this experience is like for you. And one of the things you might explore is, what is the emotion that seems to be the genesis, or seems to be interweaving itself with that striving? And often what happens, often enough, there's an emotional source or factory, in a sense, that stimulates a certain kind of obsessive kind of thinking. And unless the person enters fully into the present moment of that emotion will kind of blindly or unconsciously and subconsciously keep spitting out those kinds of thoughts. So someone who's always thinking about the future, planning, for example, one possibility of the emotion for a lot of planning is there's a feeling of apprehension, of fear. And if the fear is unacknowledged, the fear will keep doing what it does. It'll make more plans. And the person can be very good at letting go of the planning. And they let go of the planning, and then 2 minutes later or 2 seconds later, another plan comes. But if they turn their mirror of awareness back and actually allow themselves to feel in the present moment fully, kind of to place themselves in the middle of the fear and allow that to be there, then the fear has no need to create more plans. It's almost as if our thoughts and our ideas, our obsessions of the mind, they're almost like symptoms, almost like flags being waved saying, hey, you dummy, you need to pay attention to something here. And it's not what you're thinking. It's it's what's deeper than that, more fully in what's going on for you. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Good luck.
It's not something I was planning on finishing up this evening.
And now, mindfulness meditation is not supposed to be complicated. It's not supposed to be this great task of trying to figure things out. So keep that in mind also. And also, if you haven't come to the introductory course, you might come and do it. That's a good plan. Any last concern or question that you want to have? Yes.
I want just to compliment you on the way you handled that lapse of memory. I had an experience years ago in a speech tournament in front of a lot of people where I went blank, and it was so traumatic for me. And to watch you handle this, just, you know. So, with such ease, it was really nice to see.
Great. Thank you.
Maybe you should model that for me.
Well, maybe next time it happens to you, may this be a memory for you.
Oh, that would be nice. A calm memory.
Okay, let's end with a short sitting. And this time we'll do it the real way. The right way. Which means anything that happens is okay. Just be awake.